All right. So who are you, sir?
I'm Joe Armstrong.
Okay, and you do something, I think you call it Erlang?
Yeah, that's an old programming language, actually. It's one that was invented in about 1987, and it's used by Ericsson, and it's been used to build fault-tolerant systems for the last 20 years. And I think in the last 3 years, or the last 2 years, it's suddenly become very popular. Well, we can talk about why it's become popular, but
sure.
Suddenly it's, you know, flavor of the month. And it's kind of part of a trend, because it's not just Erlang that's becoming popular. It's Erlang and Haskell and this functional programming language community is becoming popular now.
Mm.
Its time has come.
Interesting. And who are you, sir?
I'm Mads Torgersen. I'm brought up in the true faith of the Scandinavian object-oriented tradition right here in Aarhus.
Huh.
And now I'm working on the C# programming language in the United States.
Excellent. So that's really, really interesting what you just said. So what exactly does that mean, the Scandinavian tradition of object-oriented programming?
Well, it means something on different levels. First of all, it means that all programming is about modeling. So what these rich domain model guys are just discovering over the pond, we've known that for years, it's all about modeling the domain, right? And you model it by modeling the concepts in people's heads. That's sort of the basic insight that object orientation was created from back in the 60s in Norway.
Interesting. So what do you think about that?
Well, I don't like object-oriented programming.
You're the other gentleman who was just in that chair. Why?
Because it doesn't model how I think, and it doesn't model how the world is. So the world's, you know, when I lecture, I say, well, the world's full of concurrency. I mean, we live in a concurrent world, and we program in a sequential way, and that is crazy. I mean, it introduces artificial difficulties into the problem. So I coined this term concurrency-oriented programming a few years ago when I tried to explain what we were doing. And I say, let's model the world around its concurrency patterns. So one way, I gave a talk at a small talk conference, and I said, well, Erlang is it's what Alan Kay would have liked small talk to be. You know, it's objects done properly. Because if you look at small talk, it's based on this idea of sending a message to an object and getting an answer back. That's the abstract model, but that's not what they actually do. So I think if you look at Java or something like that, you have this big problem, because objects model static things very nicely, but what about active objects? If you've got a clock, something that does something that has behavior, then it calls a thread. But hang on, what's a thread? It's not in Java, it's something that's in the operating system. So there's a horrible mismatch between the notion of an object and the notion of concurrency. So
you might be surprised that I agree fully with you.
You're supposed to disagree.
We'll get to that, I'm sure. That's why I emphasize that I'm out of the Scandinavian school of object-oriented programming, which is where it all started, but things never really take off until it's reinvented by the Americans, right?
Huh.
If you look at the very first object-oriented programming language, Simula, it was taking concurrency very seriously and was indeed about trying to model concurrent processes in the world going on at the same time and so on. There was no notion of thread and similar.
Yeah.
There was a notion of concurrent processes. It was just sort of unified with the object-oriented modeling world that was there. And I think to a large degree, you can discuss whether the concurrency model was exactly right on, but to a large degree, those things have been torn apart for no good reason. A lot, you know, later, as small talk became popular and as sort of the more popular object-oriented languages took off, it started out nicely together, and somebody ripped it apart just because they probably didn't know what they were doing. And now we're in this situation that you and I can be cast as opponents because one is about concurrency and the other is about objects.
Yeah. I think some people said, well, either Erlang isn't object-oriented, or it's more object-oriented than any of the object-oriented languages.
Yes.
And I think one of the reasons it's become popular, and one of the things that's happening, are changes in hardware, because there haven't been any changes in hardware for the last 25 years in processor architectures. So from 1986 to 2002, processors got sequential processors got faster by about 55 to 60% per year. That dropped to 20% between 2002 and 2005. And the reason for that is chips got bigger and bigger and bigger, mm-hmm. and the clocks got faster and faster and faster. In 2002, a single clock cycle couldn't reach all the chip. Hey, this is a catastrophe. This is the end of the road for instruction-level parallelism. So what happened after that was the chip manufacturer said, hey, let's do multi-cores. They also found that if we drop the voltage and the frequency, we can get much more performance at lower power. So in about, you know, now we have the dual cores, we have the quad cores and things like that. Now, what's going to happen when the Intel Kafer processor comes out in 2009? There'll be 32 processors on the chip, mm-hmm. right? Now, the guy who hasn't gone concurrent, maybe he's got performance problems. He's going to show his program to the people, and his boss will say, the programmer's going to say, hey, my program's got performance problems. The boss will put a CPU clock on the thing and say, you're using 3% of the CPU. You're only using one of these things. And then fire him or something. You know, I mean, it's crazy, because in order to utilize these other 63 CPUs, you have to have a good model of thread-level concurrency in your language. Now, the classic model was shared memory. And everybody thought shared memory would work. What they didn't realize, when you've got a proper concurrent CPU, that the cost of acquiring a lock, you know, you've got to stop all 64 processors to get the lock. So everything stops.
So you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater there.
So what we need are new programming models. Mm. So we can use all these processors. Now, Erlang has one of these models, and it's been doing it for 20 years. So we know how to do this, and I think everybody's going to follow.
So I wonder what you were about, really, because you said all this nice stuff in the beginning about concurrency is about modeling the concurrency that's in the world. And now you're saying we really have to do this because there are all these processes and we don't know what to do with them or how to harness them. So is this really about solving a problem that's in the hardware now, or is it about getting better programming languages?
No, it's... I think, you see, Erlang's always been there. It's been there for 20 years, and it was actually the notion of isolation was there for fault-tolerance reasons. It's got nothing to do with the multi-core thing. For example, if you want to make a fault-tolerant system, you can make it almost arbitrarily fault-tolerant by replicating it a lot and making it independent. I mean, if the chance this processor crashes is 1 in 1,000, and I'm 1 in 1,000, if they're isolated, the chance of both of them crash is 1 in 1,000,000. Mm-hmm. You've got 3 of them, the chance is, you know, 1 in 10 to the 12. No, 1 in 10 to the 9. 4 of them, it's 1 in 10 to the 12. So I'm amazed that people say it's difficult to build fault-tolerant systems. The key to that is isolation. If we can have isolated computations, we can make arbitrarily fault-tolerant systems. So that's why we share stuff. Now, we use message passing. Now, you have to have message passing in such a language because, let's suppose we're a fault-tolerant system. Mm-hmm. If you crash, I take over. So I have to have a copy of all the data that's necessary to take over. I can't have dangling pointers, shared anything. Now, that's why Erlang is as it is, because it was designed to build fault-tolerant systems. So what happens today? Well, now we have multi-cores. So if we have copied all the data, it means we can work on the data without a lock. We can run in true parallelism with you. That's why it's become popular in the last 2 or 3 years, because, hey, these multi-cores are coming. So, and it's not a speculative thing. The hardware, this is caused by the hardware. It's caused by the clock frequencies and the bigger chips. Mm. So what we found, I mean, Ericsson does products in Erlang, and we've made them go virtually twice as fast on a multi-core without changing the software. And we expect this to happen with 4 cores, 8 cores, 16 cores. And if the hardware guys are right, 1 million cores in 2019. I don't know if I believe that, but...
We'll get there at some point, I'm sure. I'm just wondering, it's all very good that I totally agree that isolation gives you all these nice properties. It just seems to me that now you're structuring your whole programming model around solving one single problem. And aren't you throwing out the baby with the bathwater in terms of all that we've learned over the years about how to structure our programs so that they have a lot of other desirable properties, such as maintainability and understandability and various sorts of static componentization? And isn't this just another solution to a single problem that ignores all the other problems and throws out all the wisdom?
No, I think there's a fundamentally different way of viewing the world, because I mean, the world is concurrent. There's an interview. You're interviewing us. If we were to model this, there are three of us.
Absolutely.
You know, there aren't three objects. There are three processes. So
yeah.
They're doing their own little behaviour. We send messages. I wave at you. It's a message that your eyes see. And, you know, we don't have shared. You know, we're not a big Siamese twin. Sort of heads glued. We don't pass messages by having our heads glued together. We use sound, and I think we understand this because if you drive a car on the motorway or something, you know, this like this, and your eyes track 50 cars behind you and, you know, 20 in front of you, you don't even think about it. Our perceptual systems are built. We've got the prefrontal cortex. So, you know, just handles concurrency. So when we write programs, if we follow the model that we see in the world, okay, this is for real world problems, you know, not for abstract, you know, there's no concurrency in matrix multiplication, that's pure mathematics, but,
sure.
You know, if you're writing a server, how do you model a server? You know, what have we got, an IRC server or Jabber server, you know, 100,000 users, we create 100,000 processes, easy, you know, I mean, well, what's the problem? You know, I have great trouble modelling that in objects. I see this in terms of processes because I can just look at the world and map it onto processes and messages. It's very easy once you get used to it.
So, but I mean, just
a natural way of thinking.
To add on to his question, though, as he was saying, I mean, for those of us who are programming, we're reared in the age of imperative programming, static typed languages. It's a lot to ask us to all of a sudden throw that away and start learning how to program in a functional way.
Right.
So
yes.
It's the imperative languages need to learn how to add functional constructs like they did with Link and VB and C#. But there needs to be more. But, I mean, what do you say to that? I mean, your opinion would be, well, just learn Erlang or learn F# or learn Haskell or learn something else to solve the problem.
I think, I don't really know. I think somebody was asking me what I thought would happen to Erlang. I thought, well, I don't know. I have no idea. But one thing that might happen, it might be rather like Smalltalk, because in a sense, Smalltalk was the language that did object-oriented correctly. And it had this devoted band of followers who followed Alan Kay, and they did this stuff. And then
a lot of them are still here today.
Yeah, right. Yes. And then another group of people came along and said, well, let's take the good ideas out of Smalltalk and put curly brackets around it so it looks like C, and it'll be popular. So they didn't take all of the ideas. They took some of the ideas and bolted it onto other languages. And we got C++, and then Java came along and it said, OK, let's redesign this and make it slightly more fundamental than that.
But so
and I don't think they captured the essence of object-oriented programming to the extent that Smalltalk did. So I think what might happen with Erlang is that you might... And it would be good if this happened. I mean, if you gave up the idea of synchronized methods, of shared memory in Java, and made Java +++, you know, where you added Erlang-style concurrency to this. I think what Erlang has done is, there's an expression on the net, which is Erlang-style concurrency. And that's a little convenient way of saying pure message passing, they copy everything, total isolation between processes, and what else? I don't know, just sort of... Let things crash if they fail. They just don't care about it. Fix it up later somewhere else. That's a sort of view of the world. And in fact, when people have added libraries to C++ and Java that just do pure message passing and mailboxes and things without the shared memory, then the programming model becomes a lot easier. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can bolt that on top of... You can bolt it on top of Java in a few libraries. But if you want to do it properly, you've got to go deep into the virtual machine.
Yes.
Because, you know, the Erlang virtual machine when it was a byte-coded machine, had a single byte instruction to create a new process, had a single byte instruction to make a new message. So context switching time, message passing time are fundamental. And you can't get that in libraries. You have to get that in the implementation. So if somebody wanted to re-engineer the JVM or the .NET virtual machine to add concurrency support... Mm-hmm. For this pure message passing, then we might see a sort of Java +++ or something which is heavily influenced by Erlang. And if it had the curly brackets and things, you know, people might like it.
Yeah.
But that might not happen. I don't know if it'll happen. At the same time, there's this great functional programming school, which is, you know, the Haskell, OCaml, Erlang. Okay, we can argue about the type systems, the laziness, but they're all based on the Lambda calculus. The Lambda calculus is not about strong types. It's about absence of side effects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes. that's the thing that unites Haskell, O'Campbell, and Erlang is the absence of side effects. It's not the fact that there's a polymorphic type system. It's not the fact that they're lazy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the art of programming without side effects that is the barrier to entry for a programmer. So my view is that, okay, choose any one of these. Choose, you know, Haskell, O'Campbell, or Erlang, and learn it. You know, and then you'll have to learn to program without side effects. That's the tricky bit. And once you've learned that, once you've learned Erlang and you want to learn O'Camel, it's going to be sort of half as difficult as it was if you were starting from scratch. And if you know O'Camel and Erlang, you know, learning Haskell is going to be really easy. So that's my view. And what does Eric think about that?
Well, so let me play devil's advocate here. So in my view, as a pure Haskell programmer, strict evaluation is a side effect, right? Because now you can observe the difference, for example, when an exception happens, you know, in the evaluation order. So only when you have truly lazy evaluation, you're completely independent of evaluation order. So how do you deal with that in like Erlang, you know?
We don't. As you know. But I mean, this is an inter-church discussion. You know, this is where the different religions clash on the interpretation of the true words of the lambda calculus. But
yeah.
You know, that's you know what I'm saying is, you know, we have more things that unite us than make us, you know.
Definitely.
I mean, if you go into the bookshop and see my little book sitting there all on the bookshelves, all lonely, you know, nobody's going to buy it. But so what I want to see is a, you know, I draw an analogy. I think C++ and Java didn't come isolated. They came more or less at the same time, and they belonged to this little family. And so did, you know, the Perl, Python, Ruby family. And I think there's going to be an Erlang, Haskell, O'Camel family. And then I think I would like people to appreciate that, you know, I think O'Camel is the substitute for C. You know, it's like C. It's sort of, you know, if you're going to write a virtual machine emulator, I think the Zen machine is written in O'Camel. I don't know if that's right. I heard that somewhere. And I think Erlang is going to be in these highly, highly distributed, you know, changing code on the fly. We can't apply type analysis to things which are just changing all the time. They're inconsistent all the time. And I think Haskell's going to be good in the business applications, actually, but where things aren't changing so rapidly and you want a lot of control over what you're doing. And one thing that I think will happen in the next few years is a differentiation of those, where people realise which of these languages is appropriate to their problem. Because all of us have said, you know, the Haskell guys have said, well, Haskell's good at everything. And the Erlang guys have said, Erlang's good at everything. And in fact, that's unrealistic, because what we see in other technologies is a differentiation, and I think that's going to happen as well. Do you agree?
And also another question is that functional programming has become really popular in financial applications.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of investment banks and so on are hiring functional programmers like crazy.
But we're doing financial stuff as well. We're doing all the streaming of the data and the distributed database. You must be doing the calculations.
Yes, exactly.
So this is very interesting. Yeah. So it is a differentiation.
So together, the side effect-free languages can rule the world.
Huh. Absolutely, yes.
And then
we sort of pretended that we were, you know, there was this period where we pretended we were object-oriented, you know, to get the publicity and stuff. And now we can sort of come out with the flag flying.
So now, what about, remember, we talked to Simon Peyton-Jones recently in Cambridge,
and he drew
this really interesting graph that had an x-axis.
A uselessness graph.
So, and his argument, and it made sense, was that side effects are good things.
The processor gets warm.
Things happen. You can actually accomplish something, and you might actually want the side effect to be the result of your algorithm, right?
Yes.
So when you talk about side effect free, what exactly do you mean?
I think that's a very good point. I mean, an Erlang program has side effects as well, right? I mean, you send a message.
Well, if my view of the world is black, you know, the world is made of black boxes, and you get a message going into the black box, and it does something, and then a message comes out. Now, it's this message coming in is the response from the real world. The message going out is what you're going to do in the real world. And what I mean by side effect free is that the computation that occurs between that going in and that coming out, that doesn't have side effects. That's what I mean. I don't mean that we're not changing the world.
Yes,
and I mean that this is referentially transparent. So if we put the same message in again, we're always going to get the same message out, so we can reason about it.
Yeah, and probably also you mean that there's no shared state, as you said in the beginning, right? Because maybe even your computations might have side effects in terms of logging or something, so that they're not really referentially transparent, right? Because the next time I run it, my log will be different. But these are kind of beneficial side effects. I think the kind of real bad side effect is where you have shared state and then there's several processes or threads kind of, you know, manipulating their shared state, and then you get trouble. But, you know, not all side effects are bad, and sometimes they are kind of necessary.
And the other thing I think that will happen and has to happen is, I think functional programmers have got to kind of get off the cloud, and you know, the books we write have to be more available to people. I mean, my son learned C++ at school, and I was kind of, oh, he's learning C++. This is really cool. And I looked at the C++ book, and it never mentioned objects or classes. It just took a very simple subset, which is a C subset. And this is really easy to learn as a beginner. You know, if you're going to teach Haskell to people, you can't throw monads at them in lesson one and say it's easy. You know? So there are subsets of these things. They're really easy. And so once you've understood the easy subset, and so what I wanted, we haven't seen the Haskell for Dummies and all these books and things.
Aaron.
And we need all this stuff.
Yes, so
because, you know, what templates in C++ are not easy to understand. You know, so we have this kind of view that functional programming's difficult to understand, and sort of, you say words like lambda calculus, and that scares off everybody.
It's because only people with very big brains have been using them so far, right? You've got to get over the reality shock actually targeting them at real people.
Yes.
And that's probably only a
chance. Yeah, so my Allen book is... That's what I did. I mean, I did it with Pragmatic, and Dave Thomas was really helpful in this. He read every chapter after it was written, and when we had a few chapters, we tried it out, and some Java programmers, and it sold really... It went straight into the bestsellers.
Yeah.
And so lots of people mailing me. Lots of people are mailing me and saying, hey, this is the first time I've understood functional programming.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there's now also a good book, this Graham Hutton's book, which is very approachable as well. So, and, you know, I really agree with you that we need to kind of take this, you know, take all the kind of difficult work out of this, because it's really easy.
I really want to encourage Erlang users, Haskell users, OCaml users, you know, the people who understand the language, to get out there and write introductory textbooks.
So, dear viewers, you're witnessing the forming of a plot to take over the world?
Absolutely. Yes.
Before we... I think what's happening here is we're agreeing so much. And so I would like to take it back to the fundamentals where we started. And you said how much Erlang models how you think about the world. So maybe you shape Erlang, but it also shaped you. I don't know, but... Is there no state in the world? Is the world stateless? Is that?
No, there's a lot of state in the world, but we don't observe it. I mean, you've got state in your brain. I don't know what it is. I can only observe it through the messages we send. And I have to infer what your state is. I don't know. I've got my own state, and I'm keeping quiet about that. You know,
but we don't have
a global state that's shared.
But when I observe you sitting in the chair, it may be that in actuality, I'm just getting a lot of signals... a lot of photons, each probably being its own process, reach my eyes, and it's all message passing under the covers. But the way I think about it is that you sit in the chair. That's the state of you right now. Don't people think in state?
Yeah.
So shouldn't we talk about things instead? I mean, our whole language is about...
But that's just a term recursive function that's sort of changing its arguments as it executes in your brain. So it's... your brain is just a lot of parallel processes that are little black boxes.
So it's like we think only differently.
We don't know how we think. I mean, that's a mystery. You know, we only observe. I can't get inside your head. I don't know how you think. I don't know how.
But you have a model of how I think. You actually have a mental model you could write down.
I don't think to some degree. I don't even know how I think. You know, so let alone how you think.
So I mean, let's talk. I mean, how? I don't think it's realistic to expect people to learn Erlang to deal with, or Haskell, or OCaml, or anything else. To deal with taking an application that they've already written, it's 500,000 lines of C++ or C# or Java or anything else, and all of a sudden figure out, well, you know, the only way we're really going to be able to exploit 64 cores is we need to get together and re-engineer this in Erlang. That's not realistic.
So how? Okay, we've got 64 cores, and it's not written thread-safe, multi, you know, and
core-safe.
Now, whatever you call it. Now. What's happened from 2005 onwards, the sequential process is actually getting slower each year, and will get slower. And as the You get environmental demands and things. As I think they, you know, the Intel Peak did a 2.3 gigahertz processor that took 120 watts or something like that, that kind of ballpark figure. As the CPUs get slower, you're going to have more. Imagine you've got 64 processors. Let's make it easy. Let's assume they're running at 1 gigahertz. Gigahertz, they'll use far less power than 2.3 gigahertz.
Okay.
So you've got 64 processors running at a gigahertz. So you're doing 64 giga instructions per second. 64 giga instructions, but that's 32 times faster, 30 times faster than the 2.3 gigahertz. Now, if your application is not thread safe, you can't run it. So, yes, you've got your 500,000 lines of legacy Java code, but you have severe performance problems because you're using 3% of the chip's concurrency. So now you're saying to me, okay, we've got to make this run on our multi-core computer subject to the constraint that we don't change anything. It's not going to work. It's not going to work.
Well, so
there's
going to
be new companies
who
come along and use new technologies and smash these ones into the Stone Age.
So could the...
That's my model.
Maybe
it's Darwinism.
Maybe you could... That's not Darwinism. Darwinism is evolutionary.
Wow, yes. Not quite.
It's evolutionary.
Dinosaur comes on. Boom, boom.
Well, oh, yeah, here and there, but yeah. That's true. But you could perhaps imagine, I mean, so trying to be constructive because you're never going to get people to do that, or you might in another 100 years' time, but you want to have some kind of more gradual... transition there.
But there's not a gradual transition. You see, what the hardware guys are telling me, the hardware people are saying, this is not an incremental change. This is a paradigm shift, right? And what's paradigm shift mean? We've added a new button. I know Microsoft thinks the paradigm shift is adding a new button to Internet Explorer. Or, no, not Internet Explorer. That's not a paradigm shift. A paradigm shift is where you break a trend that's been going on. The trend to instruction-level parallelism and making clocks faster is a trend that's 25 years long. It has stopped. It's going the other way now. Now, if people want to utilise that, they have... I think one of the reasons programming languages haven't changed much in the last 20 years is the hardware hasn't changed much. And the hardware is changing radically. We're going up in the instruction chain. With languages like Haskell. We're going down in the hardware chain with FPGAs. I think we'll squeeze out the middle ground. I don't think there's going to be a middle ground anymore, apart from the legacy applications,
and so
the big Java applications. Now, the other thing that will happen is you haven't had true concurrency before. We've had time sharing. So what is thread safe and what is tested on a time sharing system ain't going to work on a true parallel processor because the programs interleave in a different way. And people don't understand that. They do when they run on a parallel processor because the thing crashes. Hey, wait a moment, it's thread safe.
Hmm.
But hang on, it's interleaving differently. I don't think people understand that. They're going to learn. Hmm. But you understand that.
Sure. I mean, yeah. So you don't think there's any way to abstract away, I mean, it's to do the work in the machine?
No.
You don't think it's fundamentally impossible?
Yeah.
Do you think we have these big, lazy chunks of legacy code because the programming languages have been evolving so little?
No. I don't know. I think we have big chunks of legacy code because nobody understands how it works and they don't touch it. You know, don't touch. If it's not broken, don't fix it. This legacy code does that and we don't understand how or why. And then it cost an awful lot to make it. So it's going to cost an awful lot to replace. I think that argument is false, because it probably didn't cost a lot to make it. It probably cost an awful lot to maintain it every year and add features to it.
Yes.
I think the initial cost might have been rather low.
Yes.
You know, 90% of the cost is in maintenance and, you know, sort of adding features to it later. The initial cost might not be low. And it might be a lot lower than you think, because you should at least, you can use this legacy code as a specification. Mm-hmm. You know what the problem is now. So you're not attacking the same problem as before. You know, go back to observational equivalence. You know, the big, important principle of computer science: two black boxes are equivalent if I can't tell what's going on inside, and they're observationally equivalent. It doesn't really matter if you do it in Haskell or Erlang or C Sharp or inside the black box. You know, at that level of abstraction, we can replace systems.
But so I have a question here. So if you want to go to this kind of incremental model of replacing legacy software, one way to do it is to kind of rip out certain pieces of legacy software and replace them with Erlang or Haskell or something
Absolutely.
Like that. So I assume that Erlang can already talk with Legacy, you know, because, or do you really write the way down to the metal in Erlang?
No. You know, if you can talk through a socket or something. But we do force all components to talk through message channels.
Okay.
And the reason for that is safety. Because, you know, the cheap way of, or the easy way of linking stuff together is to link it into the same memory space. You know, if you've got the same stack and heap model, you can link things together. But you inherit the errors. You don't want to do that. So, you know, there are two ways of combining software. There's an easy way, which is as old as the hills. It's a socket. It's a shell, you know, the pipe mechanism. The Unix, you know... You pipe the output of that into the input of that, and that in the networks is the socket model of programming. And there's a difficult way of connecting software together, and that's the API and put them in the same memory space. Well, that is terribly difficult. Look at Unix when you just pipe things together. What Erlang does is it says that what's going between, you know, over the socket boundary, over the pipe boundary, is a structured data object, not flat text. So it's in the sense of, you know, you could use XML. Mm-hmm. As a structured term, but it's appallingly inefficient. You know, I mean, everybody agrees on that. But if you send structured terms in a nice binary format, you know, you can go 20 times as fast when you parse them. So that problem goes away. And then it's like pipes in Unix, but what you're parsing is a much higher level of abstraction, and that really makes interfacing simple. So I mean, if we could adopt standards for parsing structured terms. Because, I mean, what's XML? It says, let's parse trees with a defined grammar. That's very sensible. But parsing them in a human-readable format when no human will read it is lunacy.
That must be...
I mean, it's mad.
A waste of time,
Excellent. Well, hey, it's been great talking to you guys. I mean, this conversation could literally just keep going.
It probably will.
It probably will.
We'll carry on with
it. Totally. Sorry, Niners, but, you know, at least I'll get some of it. But... great stuff. I definitely would recommend more people to learn about Erlang.
Read the book. It's wonderful.
What is the name of the book?
I don't know. Erlang, Programming for a Concurrent World, or something like
that. Cool. Well, Joe Armstrong's recent book.
Yes.
Right.
Let's
on.
Let's go. Make it number one on Amazon.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to meet you. Great to talk to you guys.